Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Thursday, October 16th, 2025. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Vitrification begins at Hanford cleanup. U.S. Senator Cantwell of Washington says there'll be a sharp increase in health insurance costs if Congress does not renew the tax credits for the Affordable Health Care Act. We'll have an interview with Pullman City Council candidate Tawny Shumlas. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The vitrification process, turning nuclear waste into more stable glass-like logs at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, began Saturday evening. Commencement of the process comes 16 years after the original deadline to begin processing the Energy Department's worst radioactive waste into glass-like logs. According to the Washington State Standard, Department of Energy Hanford manager Ray Geimer said, as the world's largest radioactive waste treatment facility, the plant's successful startup represents a crucial achievement at this scale, demonstrating the ability to stabilize nuclear waste for safe, long-term disposal. U.S. Senator Patty Murray of Washington said, this is just the start and we've still got a ways to go before we're anywhere near done, but today's success is worth celebrating. Let's make glass. U.S. Senator Maria Cantwell, also of Washington, called the action an incredible technical and logistical accomplishment. Officials say it'll take a year to get to full operating capacity at the plant. Last year, the federal government and Washington agreed to look into encasing some of the low-activity waste in a cement-like grout. The plant started with a 25,000-gallon batch of radioactive waste, which went through two large smelters, which combined the waste with glass flakes. The melted glass slurry was then heated to 2,100 degrees and poured into giant storage cylinders to cool and harden. The nuclear process yielded plutonium for nuclear bombs during the Cold War, but also created billions of gallons of chemical and radioactive waste. Workers stored 56 billion gallons in 177 underground tanks along the banks of the Columbia River at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. The U.S. government says around a third of the tanks are leaking radioactive waste into the ground, and the plume has seeped 200 feet into the underground aquifer and into the Columbia River about 7 miles away. According to the Government Accountability Office, construction of the nuclear waste processing plant began in 2002 with a $4 billion investment. The plant was originally scheduled to come online in 2009. Officials say the production will now cost $30 billion in today's dollars. Hanford's current target calls for finishing the vitrification process by 2052. U.S. Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington issued a warning of future steep increases to health insurance costs if Congress does not renew tax credits for insurance under the Affordable Care Act. Cantwell's Deputy Director of Communications, Callie Hare, said, this is a chance to peek over the border and see what's coming for Washington State. Democrats are holding out on approving the federal budget until Congress restores health care subsidies for millions of Americans. The Daily News reports a Kaiser Family Foundation assessment estimated Affordable Care Act premiums will more than double without renewing the tax credits. Cantwell's office used an anonymous 55 and 51-year-old couple in Idaho Falls earning $65,000 per year as an example. That couple would have their monthly insurance premiums increase from $350 a month to $539. A single individual living in Coeur d'Alene earning $40,000 a year would have monthly increases from $154 to $287. Users can access information on various plans at Your Health Idaho's website by going to the pre-screener page. You're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report.
In the face of legal pressure, the Trump administration has resumed student loan forgiveness under the income-based repayment program, providing relief to borrowers who had been left in limbo after the program was paused in July. According to a 2023 report, nearly 800,000 Washington residents hold outstanding federal student loans, owing together about $28 billion. Courtney Marabetta is with the Washington chapter of the American Federation of Teachers, which filed a class action lawsuit against the Education Department, arguing the freeze was unlawful and unfair.
We have managed to finally put enough pressure on the Trump administration that they have been forced to do something that is a benefit to working Americans. It is literally life-changing to qualify.
The program allows borrowers working in public service, such as education or nonprofits, to have their remaining loan balances canceled after 20 or 25 years of qualifying payments. Marabetta adds that this ruling only applies to borrowers under the IBR program. Other income-driven repayment plans, such as SAVE or ICR, are still facing delays or legal barriers tied to court rulings. Marabetta says many AFT members end up owing much more than they originally borrowed for school despite making regular payments. She cites one example of a teacher who left grad school owing about $35,000 for her master's degree in education, and after years of making payments, owed nearly double that.
The servicers have pushed people into more expensive pathways for repayment as they have benefited from people paying more over time.
Marabetta says AFT has many members in Washington who struggle to live in the communities that they teach in, particularly for contingent faculty.
We have members who spend more time commuting than they can with students because that's simply the physical reality of working at two or three or more jobs in order to get by.
Adjunct faculty can qualify for loan forgiveness through a national policy known as the Adjunct Multiplier, Marabetta explains, which allows them to multiply their in-class instruction hours by 3.35. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
KRFP thanks its listeners and sponsors, including Tie-Dye Everything, with locally made tie-dyed items, incense, and other accessories. Tie-Dye Everything is located near 6th Street at 527 South Main Street in Moscow. For more information, you can find Tie-Dye Everything at tiedye-everything.com.
Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Dunga Dunga Brewing Company of 333 North Jackson Street in Moscow. Dunga Dunga features live music, special events, fine food, and craft beers at hungadungabrewing.com and on Facebook and Instagram.
We now have the first in our series of interviews with Pullman City Council candidates, an interview with Tawny Shumlas. There are six candidates running in three contested races for Pullman City Council seats this year. Voters can only cast ballots in the races for the wards they live in. Tawny Shumlas is running for a Ward 3 position, which represents mainly the western part of the city. She's running against John Castleman. Shumlas and Castleman were the top two vote getters in an eight-way primary race for the Ward 3 seat representing the western part of the city. KRFP citizen journalist Brenda Cox interviewed Tawny Shumlas last night.
My name is Tawny Shumlas, and I am running for city council because I really believe that Pullman can take a more pro or get to yes stance when it comes to things like businesses and housing and building a really positive culture.
How do you plan on making yourself available to constituents beyond emails and phone calls?
I think I'm very lucky in that my role in this town is already as a person that people can come and talk to, they can bring their ideas to and their frustrations to, and I will sit and listen. I am not in an office somewhere where you can't find me. I'm literally in the middle of the town, and I'm here, and I'm all ears. So I hadn't thought really that I needed to do much more than that, because I already feel like I'm reaching a lot of people. But I have really started adding the number of ways that I'm reaching out to people over social media. So I'm on Nextdoor, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and now I've started a newsletter, which I'm hoping to do once or twice a month. At this point in time, I'm really just covering like what I'm doing, the meetings and what's going on, but I'm going to be starting to fill in with my theory of the case on those things, like what I think something means. So I'm really hoping to get outreach and that people then can communicate back to me on all of those channels.
Okay. How can Pullman capitalize on its new downtown now that the downtown revitalization project has finished?
It's time for Pullman to get to yes and to take action. They are trying to start a farmer's market, and the Moscow Farmer's Market has said, we're ready to help you. We have vendors, we have stuff we can give you and help you, but we really think you need to have it on Main. So we went to the city, and the city just hemmed and hawed, and they didn't do it. And we're just asking that they close one block so trucks can still come down Main, and then they would turn right at Kamiakin, then they could just jot right out of town. And so we're asking that during those really slow hours of Saturday morning that they take it very seriously, that we be allowed to move the traffic. We move traffic for the entire project. I think we can do it for a couple hours on Saturday morning. But doing things like that, starting to put an action plan into place of things that can be done downtown, I think is the next step. They did start to do that with this wonderful dinner that they had, community dinner this last month. It was really wonderful. And I would like to just see more events like that.
Okay, what do you see as the relationship between the city council and the mayor? Who does what and who is ultimately responsible for the policies and actions voted on by the city council?
I am a small business owner, so learning about government has been a bit of a learning curve for me, and I'm sure that what I think happens will probably be met with the reality of what happens. But I know that city council and mayor are all elected officials who are, I hesitate to say part-time because I think it's more full-time, but the idea is that it's more of a part-time basis, and then city staff and are the full-time, like, paid people of the city. So they're the ones who really, at the direction of city council, then goes and looks at the different policy decisions and maps out the different plans that could be taken. Then they bring that back to city council. So the city council has directed them what to do. They've gone and figured out all the stuff. Then they go back to city council with the different ideas and plans, and then city council votes on that. I do know that we're in a strong mayor system, which means that the mayor really has a lot of power, but I don't know what that means yet in terms of how it would affect my job if I became a city councilor. These are all things I look forward to learning. I'm very excited. I think like Sean Wells was amazing. I think Sean Miller, who's our economic advisor, is amazing. I haven't met anybody at the city that I don't like, so I'm really excited to get in there and start figuring out what my job would be.
All right. What are some ways you can gain input from the larger community members that are not so tuned in to city business?
Well, I can go to them. I can try and reach them through my social media, and then encourage them to email me or come and talk to me at Rico's. But really, it's going to be on me to get to them.
Okay. What are your ideas around attainable, affordable housing for Pullman, for the Pullman workforce? And and for low-income housing. What are your thoughts on a housing committee or housing work group? Should the city be working on this, a mechanism for a housing authority?
So I joined last month, and I will be going to the next meeting, or my next meeting next week, the pro-housing, Pullman Pro-Housing Group, which is working with the land trust that's actually based in Moscow. So the idea is that they will have affordable housing because the land trust owns the land, and then people can buy the house. Then when they sell the house, it wouldn't ever go up a ton in value. It would go up a little bit in the equity that they put in the house, but because you're not selling the land, it wouldn't see those huge jumps like you get, you know, with a regular house. And they're thinking there's going to be about 30 units. This might end up being like duplexes, maybe some smaller homes, maybe one small apartment building, but it wouldn't be apartments. It would all be things that you would buy. But you know, more of a mixed density units. And I absolutely think that Pullman has to get in and start making it easier for permitting, start making it easier for people to build here. We really need affordable housing in Pullman just desperately. This is a good start, though, this pro-housing group, and hopefully we'll be able to get more going.
Okay, with the reduction in federal funding to Washington State, and therefore to Whitman County, how do you suppose the city of Pullman should proceed with its operations, with its city operations, and you know all that it provides?
I watched last night's city council meeting, and the budget is a problem. There's a budget shortfall. I don't think there's any way around.
How big is the shortfall?
I think it was $31 million was what they had planned out, and it's coming in at $29 million, something like that. I took pictures. I'd have to go back and look. Sorry, I was trying to be...
It's okay.
I was trying to go around them. Okay. There is no doubt about the fact that there's probably going to be a hit to services. And everybody has a favorite service that they're not going to want to see get hit. I think that emergency services should be the last to get touched because our safety is very important. But what my idea is that we need to be working harder to find new revenue sources to try and bridge the gap. And that can be done, I think, by being pro-business. If you make the permitting easier and make it easier for a business to get into a building and to get started, so if you kind of alleviate some of the permitting fees and whatnot on the front end, you get that business going, and then you get the sales tax, you get the use tax, and you start getting that money flowing in, that'll start making up the difference. And especially if it's a good business. You know, there are manufacturing businesses out there that are looking for good towns. Mm-hmm. I learned about one tonight. I wish I could remember the name. I'm so sorry. That is looking for a good place to open up manufacturing wing of their business. And then that will bring in people that can afford housing because those are good jobs. And, like, we should be courting those companies, getting them here, getting them started, and then we can start building houses for those people, and then we get that property tax. So then you get that sales tax and that property tax coming in. Like, we should be like a small business and just be ruthlessly chasing money. Like, go find your customers and get them in the door. And that's what I think that the ideas that I can bring having a small business myself.
Somebody asked me to ask this to you. not you specifically, but to all the candidates. If someone comes to you with a concern about a policy that's just been passed, what would you do to help that person be heard? And would you, and how would you, address them and get them the info that they needed, the information that they needed?
Absolutely. Well, I would make sure to write it down or to have them email it to me so that I had the right words. I think words have power. And then I would escalate that. I would find the person that knows the answer. I would escalate it to that person. I do know sometimes in Pullman there's an issue of being sent from person to person to person because everybody says that somebody else knows the answer. And in that instance, I would either just have to go right to Sean Wells and the mayor, or I would just have to start making the answers myself. Because you need answers. And it's not, it's really disheartening when you get bounced from place to place. And so it's time that we have all the answers in one place for people to find.
Okay. Are there any closing thoughts or anything that I didn't touch on that you would like the listeners to know?
My big theory of the case we already discussed, which is we need to just ruthlessly go after new business and building new homes. That way we can see a return in that money, the taxes to the city. But I also think that we need to start building fun. We need to build a personality. We need to build events, things that make Pullman memorable. And so that's something I would really like to be involved in.
Okay. Thank you, Tani.
Yes.
And that was our interview with Tani Shumlas, who is running for a Ward 3 seat on the Pullman City Council. Her opponent is John Castleman. This was the first in our series of interviews with Pullman City Council candidates during the general election this year. We'll have more interviews with candidates coming up on future editions of Morning Mix and the Evening Report. Ward 3 represents the western part of the city. In an 8-way August 5th primary for the seat, Shumlas had 302 votes and Castleman had 299 votes. There are two other races for seats on the 7-seat city council this year. Trevor Vance and Didi Labash will face off in November for the Ward 2 Pullman City Council seat, which represents the north-central part of the city. Brian McDonald and John Mark Mankey will face off for a Ward 1 seat, which represents much of the southern and eastern part of the city. There are four council members with 2 years remaining in their terms. The Ward 1 council member is Ann Parks. Nathan Weller represents Ward 2, and he's not up for election until 2027, and Pat Wright represents Ward 3. The at-large representative, also not up for election until 2027, is Eric Fajerin.
9 out of 10 cases of cardiac arrest are fatal, but preparedness can save lives. And a teacher at Mackenzie River Community School is living proof. When the school's registered nurse, Liz Moosey, noted medical equipment used in the event of cardiac arrest was in disrepair, she launched an upgrade campaign. Her foresight paid off when a teacher experiencing cardiac arrest collapsed in the hallway just outside Moosey's door. Moosey, a CPR instructor for the American Heart Association, sprang into action.
She walked out of my office and another teacher walked out right behind her and literally seconds later started screaming, "Help, help." So I got her on the ground. and I just started CPR.
Moosey continued CPR while another staff member called 911, and soon the teacher resumed breathing on her own. But the presence of a trained responder and modern life-saving equipment helped make the difference. Today is World Restart a Heart Day, a global initiative aimed at raising awareness about the importance of cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, known to improve survival rates from sudden cardiac arrest. For Moosey, upgrading the school's equipment wasn't enough. She also developed a cardiac emergency response plan and began assembling a team, organizing drills, and training staff. Knowing CPR and how to use an automated external defibrillator, or AED, can double or triple the chance of survival in the event of cardiac arrest. She says you don't need to be a medical professional to save a life.
It's possible with just basic hands-only CPR, you can save a life. Anyone can call 911 and start CPR and get an AED on.
The American Heart Association is working to pass policy through the Oregon legislature that would ensure all public schools have accessible and workable AEDs, a written cardiac emergency response plan, and that they require CPR training for appropriate staff. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
Missoula is using a $9.3 million federal Safe Streets and Roads for All grant to redesign its high-risk South Avenue corridor, an area with schools and a regional park that has experienced multiple pedestrian fatalities. Aaron Wilson, the city's planning manager for the mobility department, says the funding allows them to address long-standing safety gaps and implement proven safety solutions much more quickly than local resources would allow.
Oftentimes we can identify we have a problem. We know this corridor has issues that we can solve, but we often don't have the funding to do that, especially as we get into the $10 million or more. That can be hard for small cities and local governments to fund a project like that.
The project is still in design, but it's expected to add sidewalks, safer crosswalks, and bicycle lanes. Construction is scheduled to begin in 2027. The Missoula project reflects a broader national push for cleaner, safer transportation infrastructure funded by recent laws like the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. Tina Hodges authored a report on the national impact of the law with Atlas Public Policy.
So Congress addressed these gaps in the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and provided funding for these kind of underfunded and newer clean transportation strategies. And so what the report looks at are what are some of the benefits for that.
Hodges says those benefits include cleaner air, new manufacturing jobs, and more affordable ways to get around. Hodges notes that the current federal transportation authorization expires in September 2026, and Congress will soon decide whether to continue funding more of these programs. This is Tramell Gomes for Big Sky Connection.
Farmers in Wyoming and across the U.S. face many stressors, from economic troubles to unpredictable weather, and they have one of the highest rates of suicide of any occupation. Behavioral health care providers are now being taught a new method to identify depression, anxiety, and other issues among farmers. LandLogic co-developer Kayla Anderson, who grew up on a farm, says farmers don't typically talk about their emotions, but asking them to draw a map of their land and explain what happens and where helps start a conversation that can reveal underlying emotional struggles.
Because we believe that licensed behavioral health providers that may be wanting to serve this population just need that one little piece to connect, and then their knowledge and expertise and their work with the farmer can take off from there.
A cattle feedlot, for instance, might be a source of intense stress when there isn't enough money to feed the cattle, or a reliable field of alfalfa could be a place where a farmer finds solace. Anderson notes farmers are problem solvers by necessity. The therapists LandLogic trains learn how to identify mental health issues using associations with everyday agricultural tools, like a pair of favorite work gloves. They then help farmers learn to overcome challenges on their own as they spend time out on their land. Therapists are also taught how to identify 10 common negative thinking patterns that Anderson calls barbed wire thinking, including toxic grit, when farmers continue to toil away even when it's causing them harm.
The get her done, pull yourselves up by the bootstraps, there's no time for emotions. That piece is part of what has kept farmers farming and is a very good skill set until the moment it's not.
Farmers are good at their jobs because they're deeply attached to their land and are at risk when that role is threatened. Anderson says the moment they see how this agricultural imperative impacts their behavior is a launching point. Once they can name it, they can own it and work it out.
Naming it and claiming it is one of the most important parts of land logic for the farmer because it brings so much light and you can see it. You can see it visibly when they have that moment of clarity. And that's really powerful and awesome to watch.
This is Eric Galatis for the Wyoming News Service.
And that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area, it will be partly cloudy tonight, low 35, mostly sunny tomorrow, high 58, south winds 5 to 15, becoming west in the afternoon, gusts up to 25. Mostly clear, low 31 Friday night, increasing cloud Saturday, high 57, 70% chance of rain Saturday night, mainly after midnight, otherwise cloudy, low 41, between a quarter and a half inch of rain possible, and on Sunday, 90% chance of rain, high 53. Currently 50 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. You can also go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio or your nonprofit. You can adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button as well. And once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast, and Brenda Cox also assisted. Have a good evening. Flashpoints is coming up next. We'll have the election crimes bulletin with Greg Pallast. They had a little bit of it at the beginning of the show, and then they went to the Intifada newscast and then went back to Greg Pallast in the later part of the show, and that'll run till 7:30. At 7:30, we will have Appearing Locally, where we feature music from artists that are appearing in the Moscow Pullman area in the near future, till 8 o'clock. First Wave on at 8, and at 9 o'clock, we'll have music from Connecting the Notes, where it features a different artist every hour. At 11 o'clock till 1 a.m., jam band music with The Ride. Stay tuned for more KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by listeners like you and by Moscow Contemporary, which connects, supports, and creates community through art and arts education. Moscow Contemporary is located at 2012 West Pullman Road and moscowcontemporary.org.
KRFP is dedicated to the progressive values of multiculturalism and freedom of expression.